So I'm going to be signing a national emergency. And it's been signed many times before. It's been signed by other presidents. From 1977 or so, it gave the presidents the power.
For the balance of the year and into 20, I don't believe we retest the lows that we had on December 24th. I think the clarity that we got from the Federal Reserve, and if we get some resolution on a couple of hurdles, one of them certainly the government shutdown today is good news that there's a resolution there.
We're still talking about the NASDAQ being more than 10% below where we were from its peak.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Congress reaches a budget deal. The national debt crosses $22 trillion, and Amazon pulls out of New York with a loss of 25,000 jobs. Finally, the president declares a national emergency to build the wall. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in Hour 1, Ari Wald from Oppenheimer will be joining me. He says the S&P 500 is in a narrow trading range, 2,600 to 2,800, with a possible breakout. Also later on in the program, John Maddox will be joining me as we talk about mortgages and securitization. And of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
And coming up in Hour 2, the big picture, we set a record this week. The national debt rose to $22 trillion, and we're not even in a recession. Well, why aren't people talking about this? Also, Jim Poplava wrote an article about a financial crisis in the Roman Empire in 33 AD that involved efforts to stimulate real estate, and it led to a credit crisis eventually solved by quantitative easing. 33 AD, quantitative easing, and negative interest rates have a long history. That's coming up in Hour 2, The Big Picture. Let's turn now to the market wrap report with Ryan Poplava. Ryan, what moved the market this week?
Well, this week was about the budget agreement, optimism around trade talks, and a bad December retail sales report that failed actually to discourage the bulls and was yet another opportunity for money on the sidelines to join in. Now, this week we saw the market pass another key technical goalpost with the S&P 500 joining the Dow Jones Industrial Average above its respective 200-day moving average. So let's get into the weeds here, Chris. This week, the trade talks continued in Beijing with Deputy Trade Representative Jeffrey Gerrish, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, and Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer. And even though Trump confirmed last week he wouldn't meet with President Xi Jinping before the March deadline, we heard last week that the deadline could be moved. And several times this week, that was confirmed with various headlines. So towards the end of the week, the White House issued a statement that trade talks will continue next week in Washington. The U.S. and China have agreed that any kind of commitment will be stated in a memoranda of understanding between the two countries. And it's likely that in an agreement, we will probably hear China pledge to purchase more goods and services, which we actually have already heard in the past, said that they would plan to do, especially in the agricultural side of things, to reduce the trade deficit. But some sticky issues still kind of remain. And that's maybe what Kudlow is always referring to, that we're still very wide and far apart on some of the issues. And that would, they're referring to basically forced technology transfer, intellectual property rights, and cyber theft. These are some very key issues, not very easy to tackle. And, how do they tackle this if they do agree to something? So we have yet another 2 weeks before the March 1 deadline hits. And again, that can be extended, as they've said they possibly could do. Even Trump has tweeted about it. So optimism over trade continues to support this market. Now, the U.S. stock market got a big lift Tuesday when Congress reached an agreement to provide funding with a $1.5 billion assessment set aside for, they said, 55 miles of a wall along the border with Mexico, which did not meet what Trump wanted. He was wanting something towards like $5 billion, I think. But it did create a tentative agreement to prevent another government shutdown. Now, Trump later in the week acknowledged he'd signed the bill, and on Friday announced he will declare a national emergency to divert funds from the Department of Defense and Treasury at roughly $6.5 billion to build the wall. Now, this could be challenged in the courts, with Congress separately moving to block it with a resolution after they come back from recess next week. But whatever happens, it looks like we've avoided another shutdown discussion, since the question of building a wall now is totally a separate matter. So the official retail sales, this is where things got very interesting this week. This report for December, the official government report, showed that there was a dramatic decrease in retail sales. They said that the retail sales were down 1.2%, with a downward revision to November sales to 0.1% increase only. So that was down. Now, that's the largest decline, the 1.2%, largest decline since September of 2009. So when you exclude autos, which actually did very well, retail sales were actually down 1.8%. Now, it wasn't mainly due to gas sales, which was down 5.1%. Furniture was down. Electronics were barely down. Clothing was down. Miscellaneous store retailers were down 4.1%. Non-store retailers were down 3.9%, and restaurants were also down. Now, the Honey Badger market didn't care. While the S&P 500 was down as much as 0.8% in the early go of things on Thursday, a rally ensued throughout the rest of the day on a buy-the-dip reaction to the S&P 500 dropping. And so we closed the day only down 0.3% in the face of, again, the worst retail sales number since September of 2009. Now, there were other reports later in the day, and I found this very interesting, like the one from the National Retail Federation. That's a private association that contradicted the official report. The NRF stated that holiday retail sales between November and December, so 2 months, grew 2.9% over 2017. Now, they said online spending was up 11.5%. Clothing was up. Health and personal store sales were up. General merchandise sales were up. Groceries were also up. Now, the only thing that was down was sporting good sales. So many looked at the retail sales report as maybe too bad to be right, especially taking into account that some of the private reports from the NRF, and if you recall, the MasterCard Pulse report on December 26th was one of the key catalysts reversing the downtrend in December that week. Real briefly, Chris, I wanted to summarize some of the key points on the earnings season so far, because we've had about 79% of the S&P 500 report thus far. Now, the positive responses to announcements by the number of companies has been higher this quarter versus the previous quarter. Previous quarter, when we looked at how did companies react after results, only 50% went higher after they announced their results. 60% have gone higher this quarter. So that's much better. The issue now is that first quarter estimates are expected to decline 2.5%. The key culprits for the decrease are energy. Energy is expected to drop 15% in earnings. Information technology down 10%. Materials down 9%, and really low digit declines for the rest. But the only areas that we're expecting to see any kind of earnings growth next quarter, in the first quarter of 2019, is healthcare up 6%, utilities up 4%, industrials up 3%. But according to Capital IQ, the S&P 500 currently trades, this is as I'm looking at it here on Friday, at 16.6 times forward earnings for 2019, which is in line with the average over the last 5 years. So if we have another quarter of negative earnings growth, it would not be good for this market.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
What happens with the trade front with China and the U.S. is a pivotal aspect to everything. And I, like many investors, are going under the growing assumption that the odds of a deal being completed are rising, and the market is partly rising upon that confidence level that keeps on increasing. I don't think it's so much the Fed or other factors, government shutdown, starting up again, shutting down, starting up again. I think it's more just the prospect of the looming deadlines for a trade deal that was targeted as March 1st. And I think we all know that there's increasing odds that it'll be pushed off further, which is perhaps good news because it'll mean that a framework confidence level is rising for a deal. So that is sort of a backdrop that we have a floor under the market as long as that deal prospect is high.
Aside from the broader outlook, Kurt also discussed the technical backdrop of the market, the levels he's targeting in the weeks and months ahead in today's program, and what he expects for the U.S. dollar, commodities, energy, and the emerging markets. If you want to hear this full interview, all you have to do is go to financialsense.com and click where it says subscribe.
What's your retirement goal? When it comes to retirement, you've probably heard it's all about achieving your number. At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we believe retirement is all about you. You are not a number. You can achieve your retirement dreams and goals. Let us help you create a consistent source of income, make the best choices on Social Security and Medicare benefits, and build your legacy for the future. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939. Let's work together and make your dreams come true. Call 888-486-3939 today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Who knows how this year is going to turn out? Last year, everything was looking good on the fundamental side, but we had a downdraft towards the end of the year. What will 2019 look like? At least right now, things are looking pretty good. Joining us from Oppenheimer and Company is Ari Wald. Ari, let's talk about some key themes that you guys are looking at. You believe, at least right now, that the S&P is going to be in a trading range between 2,600 and 2,800. Explain that.
That is correct. I think for now we're in a trading range. Before talking about where we think we're going, let's talk about where we've been. And speaking in terms of the selling, the dramatic selling that we saw in the fourth quarter, that reached our threshold of what we would call a small bear market. Looking at our bear market checklist, pretty much everything was reached except for time duration. It was a very short downdraft. It was very condensed. So looking ahead, as the market has had this very strong one-way rally off the December low, we're back into the range that we were in October and November, between 2,600 and 2,800. I think we can get the time duration now at this higher level ahead of what we think is going to be a new bull market, that our emphasis is less so on trying to time this trading range and more so on the bigger picture recovery that we think is taking place.
Ari, this may seem to remind me of a key word, the R word. Last year, towards the end of the year, that R word was bandied about and it was about recession. Now I hear the R word again, but this time it's talking about reflation. So maybe that's the catalyst that gets us to the new bull market. Let's talk about if we move out or break out of this trading range, you have some key themes, and that is the U.S. and EM over the developed world. Tell us why you think that to be the case. In other words, the U.S. is still a good place to be.
I think the U.S. is still the attractive bet here, that until we get the all clear, I think the U.S. still offers a very attractive risk reward. When talking about the rotation into developed areas like Europe, to us, to frame that backdrop, one has to have a very bullish, we say you have to be more bullish than we are. We have to see global growth come back and rates in these, in the Eurozone and Asian countries as well start to move higher. You'll get rates in the U.S. higher, a steeper yield curve. Reflation will come back, and that's the backdrop where developed world areas of the market should outperform, where value should outperform. While we're still in this in-between, we still prefer the U.S. and areas of the market with more exposure to technology and high growth themes. EM has become also a story of technology, where the largest weighting within EM is now the combination of technology and communication services. It makes up about 30% of EEM. You know, at one point, if you looked, ranked the performance of all the major global regions, that you could pretty much rank them, the performance similarly by the composition of the tech sector. So I think the overriding theme for us is that we are in this secular bull market, and it should be driven by higher growth companies in the technology sector. That we think that is what's going to lift the market higher over the coming years. And for the time being, you know, while we still have fluctuating interest rates and fluctuating commodity prices, we think those areas with the most tech, like the U.S. and like EM, are attractive places to be.
And as we look at the stock market internals, you like large caps for the long term, small caps for the risk on trade. So if we go into a new bull market, wouldn't that imply the risk trade is on, or are you breaking those two out separately?
I think, yes, I think small caps are at a point where they tend to outperform at the early stages of a new bull market. And I think as we talk about the performance off the December low, small caps have outperformed. Right? I think looking at the big rally that we've had over the last month, we have seen the characteristics of this new bull market that's taking place. For the long term, looking at some of the relative ratios between the S&P 500 and the Russell 2000, following 20 years of small cap outperformance, there are some signs that there could be this longer term turn into large caps. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing. You know, while we are making the case that small caps, due to their higher beta, should be attractive risk on trade when we're confident that the macro is turning higher, through much of the 1980s and 1990s, large caps led on the upside through that past secular bull market. So large caps for the long term, actually consistent with this secular bull market thesis that we've been discussing.
Right now, value stocks seem to be doing much better than, let's say, growth stocks. Is that a reflection of the corrective period that we just went through?
It's actually the other way around. Growth stocks have been doing much better over most time frames. That even since mid-November, the Russell Growth Index has started once again to outperform Russell Value. However, again, framing the macro environment where value would need to outperform, I think we're getting close to that condition, that similar to 2016, when we had the new upcycle in the equity markets, that's when value started to outperform again. And I think we're at that point. So while we love growth for the long term, I think now that we're getting a little more confident about the macro conditions and improving, we're starting to nibble on some value stocks as well.
You seem to have this theme of growth. You're talking about growth for the long term. And then when we narrow that down and drill it down to, let's say, dividend type stocks, you like dividend growth over high dividends. So I would think something like an Apple that pays 2% or less, but is growing at double digits, is better than, let's say, a utility stock or a REIT.
That's right. Dividend growth, there's more of a quality aspect of it. They sometimes get called these chicken cyclicals. While there, it's an area of the market that won't kill you on a downdraft, they outperform. Both dividend growth and high dividend outperformed in the fourth quarter. Dividend growth has typically can participate more on the upside. And for that reason, we think dividend growth for those looking for a lower volatility play is more attractive than high dividend. As we talk about this secular bull market, I think on a relative basis, it's a secular bear market for high dividend themes that I think could underperform in that backdrop.
Let's talk about some intermarket relationships, and I want to move over to interest rates. We saw them hit 3.25% before the downdraft in December, and now we're in that 2.7% range. You see rates range-bound as well as stocks. In other words, 10-year ranges between 2.5% and 3%. Explain that.
That's right. It's very difficult for us to make the case that interest rates in the United States are going to move meaningfully higher when you have near zero rates in other parts of the world, you know, specifically in the Eurozone and Asia. So we think there's an anchoring that's going to continue to play out, that's going to limit the upside for the 10-year. I think we have had a downturn in the 10-year from when it was at 3.2% in the fourth quarter to more recent readings at around the low at 2.55. And I think we're at the point where now rates are finding the lower end of its range. So I think that's the backdrop that we have, where 2.5%, let's call it, at the lower end of the range, 3% on the higher end of the range. And I think rates continue to trade in that directionless manner.
So if we look at that, let's talk about the U.S. dollar.
You know, for us, the dollar, and you started talking about, you know, the reflationary tailwinds that we could see to help catalyze the next upleg in the market. I think really the U.S. dollar has been the key neutralizing factor here, where you've had points where the dollar has weakened considerably. For instance, in that 2017 period going into 2018, you had dollar weakness that helped provide some of those reflationary tailwinds. And then you'll have points where the dollar strengthens and it helps limit inflation. And it's created this not too hot, not too cold environment. And I think that's really the key catalyst for us, speaking in terms of these intermarket trends. Due to the inverse correlation, you know, we think you'll have a stable dollar leading to stable commodity prices. And historically, that has been the backdrop where you've seen strong performance in the equity market. You know, we think back to the 1950s and the 1960s and 1980s and the 1990s. You had range-bound commodity prices and an overriding secular bull market in stocks.
Now, when we're talking about the dollar, let's move on to commodities. And I want to start out specifically with two key commodities. One is gold and one is oil. What's your take on both of them?
So within what we're framing as this secular non-bull market for commodity prices, we're essentially, we think both metals and energy oils are in this longer term trading range. We think the price of West Texas Intermediate crude is in a range between $45 and $55. We see a lot of similarities to how West Texas traded in the 1990s, that aside from a brief spike during the Gulf War, crude oil more or less traded in a $10 range between $15 and $25. We think similar actions playing out yet again. The price of gold has had has been in a base for longer. It's been range bound for about 5 years now. 1375 is the key upper limit. And you could see gold prices move much higher if they could get through 1375, you get a breakout there. We question if you could see that type of action without a significantly weaker U.S. dollar. You know, we remind investors, you know, during the last big run-up in commodity prices from 2001 to 2011, you had a near 50% haircut in the U.S. dollar DXY index when that went from about the 120 level to 70. We're expecting dollar to be more range-bound, and in turn, we think these commodity prices are going to be range-bound as well.
So boiling this down as an investor, if we can sum up some of the themes, U.S. and emerging market over a developed world, large caps for the long run, growth for the long term, and dividend growth. So let's break that down into sectors. Your two favorite sectors are technology and healthcare. And fundamentally, that would make sense if you take a look at all the technological innovations we're seeing, not just in our iPads, our smartphones, but even what's happening in the energy sector, and then also an aging boomer population, not only here, but around the world. So let's talk about technology and healthcare as your two favorites.
Yeah, for technology, which is really our high conviction goal, it's been for some time and it continues to be. What really stands out to us is how broadly strong that sector is across both capitalizations and industries. You know, while some would try to make the case that it's been a very narrow led move in technology by few large cap names. That can't be farther from the truth. It's been large caps. It's been mid caps. It's been small caps. We have more recently had the S&P 400 mid cap technology sector break through 15-year resistance relative to its relevant mid cap benchmark. Not only that, it's across industries. There's been some rotations within the sector. It's gone from FANG and internet names to semis to now software, and you're seeing some signs of moving back to semis. Really across the board, that's telling to us. You can't make that case for any other sector of the market. So that is the basis for why we think that we're in a secular bull market for stocks, and it's going to be led by the technology sector and its higher growth attributes.
Yeah, I was just going to say, is this a reflection of overall your growth theme? Because as I look at some of your themes, growth for the long term, dividend growth for the long term, and if you look at sectors, one of the fastest growing and best growing sectors in the market has been technology, whether you're looking at top line growth or bottom line profits.
And think about it this way also, Jim. Two of the key drivers of these sector rotations in recent years have been interest rates and commodity prices. And we're making the case that interest rates and commodity prices are going to remain in a range. So instead of interest rates up and you have a trade into a value sector like financials and interest rates down, and you'll see those flows go back to utilities, and conversely, with energy prices up, everyone buys energy stocks, and then it goes the other way. Technology, through those ebbs and flows, has been all-weather leadership. It's been had a near zero correlation to rates and commodities, which we really like, and I think that's going to be driving force of why that outperformance continues.
When you look at this, Ari, and you know, when you're looking at a trading range in the short run, but you think this breaks out and we begin another leg up in a bull market, I always try to think, what could make this scenario go wrong? In other words, if you're expecting this to happen, but if there's something that turns the market in a different direction than you expect, what would that be?
That's a great question, Jim. And how we've been framing it, it's been a good start, speaking in terms of the rally off the December low. But more is needed. It's been a good start where we have had good participation. We have new four-month highs in the New York Stock Exchange advanced decline line. We have new highs in the stocks above their 200-day moving average. It's been the right areas leading the way higher. We have semiconductors breaking out to the upside. We have Chinese equities stabilizing and turning up as well. However, we haven't had the breakout just yet. We're still stuck below 2800. There's still a lot of stocks still stuck below resistance. And if we start to see this sideways range play out, but we see the leadership turn back to more higher dividend, lower volatility, defensive sectors like consumer staples and REITs and utilities, if we start to see credit spreads start to widen again, if we see interest rates failing to hold this 2.5% support level, if they instead start to break lower, that if you look at the big tops in the year 2000 and 2007, they coincided with big downturns in interest rates. That would give us concern. That would suggest to us that the market is starting to weaken internally, and the overall market should follow.
So given where we are now, you expect this trading range somewhere between 2,600 and 2,800. We're close to 2,800 now. What would you be doing if you were an investor? Let's say you've been sitting on the sidelines or you have cash to deploy. What would you do?
Well, I think it's important to own stocks here. I think you want to de-emphasize trying to market time and getting too cute with what should be this directionless market, and start dollar cost averaging your way into the market, you know, both within the technology sector and some of the higher momentum software names. And then for those looking for newer ideas, I think you can start to purchase some of those stocks that haven't participated, that have been basing and are starting to turn higher. You know, we're more comfortable working down the momentum ladder and looking for rotation ideas as macro conditions start to improve. And I think you have the setup to make that case.
All right. Well, listen, Ari, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, tell them how they can do so, please.
Well, they could follow me on Twitter. My handle is my name, at Ari Wald.
All right. Ari, as always, thanks for coming on the program. Great stuff. Have yourself a great weekend.
You as well, Jim. Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Whenever you mention a new tax or raising taxes, I think, you know, a lot of people get squeamish thinking, I don't want to have to pay more for this. What would you say to that?
This is an investment, not a tax. You're already paying $3,400 a year as a family because of the current state of play, the current level of underinvestment in U.S. infrastructure. So you're already paying an invisible tax of $9 a day. And for roughly the cost of a nice cup of coffee for a little over $4 a day, we can eliminate that drag on the economy, put people to work in good paying jobs right now. And as, you know, industry and businesses get drawn into the areas that are making these, you know, modernization and upgrades to their infrastructure now and going forward, it'll be good in the long run for the U.S. too.
Well, if there's good news, if you're in the real estate market, it's that mortgage rates have come down. Even though prices have been going up steadily, the affordability index has come down. So welcome news if you're shopping in the mortgage market or you're going to sell a home. We're going to take a look at the real estate market following up last week with CoreLogic. And today, joining me on the program is John Maddox. He's CEO at FunLoans. John, I want to begin our conversation in terms of over the last year, we saw a backup in mortgage rates. I think we got close to 5% in October, in November. From the mortgage perspective, how did that impact your business or, let's say, your clients? Did you find that people were maybe hesitant to make a commitment to buying a home, shying back? What were you seeing in the business at the time?
Thanks for having me on, Jim. That's a great question. What I would say is, since we focus on, you know, your self-employed borrowers, we actually, my business didn't have much of an effect with the rates rising because our rates are loans that we sell to hedge funds, private equity funds. We're not selling them to Fannie Freddie typically. But to answer your question, we definitely saw that it affected the mortgage business in a massive way. I mean, we saw many people laying off, you know, good, talented underwriters and processors just because it slowed down so much. So we were thankfully able to pick up some really good talent for our company. But several rate hikes actually just really brought the mortgage business to a screeching slowdown. So it affected it dramatically, especially all the refis. So the refis went away. You know, the people that were looking to buy a house, a lot of them, you know, looked at potentially, you know, looking, you know, waiting. And so it did definitely affect the overall mortgage business and real estate market.
Let me ask you another question related to real estate, because we've seen real estate prices go up year after year over the last 4 or 5 years, in fact, rising faster than most individuals' income. When you see something like that, have you seen a trend where somebody's saying, you know what, we have a house that we've lived in, we'd like to get a new house, but it's too expensive. You know what, we're going to take out a home equity loan and we're just going to remodel the house. Have you seen anything like that?
Absolutely. That actually is one of the most likely reasons for someone to pull cash out. We're seeing a lot of people, you know, look at the lack of inventory and they just say, yeah, I want a loan to pull cash out and to do home improvements. And a lot of it's just because there really isn't much on the market as far as, you know, new brand new homes. And for someone to get exactly what they want, sometimes they just have to do it themselves, I guess. And so we have seen quite a big uptick in cash out refinances.
You know, that's the one thing that has really struck me about this economic recovery is, John, unlike, let's say, the last decade, and I'm sure you can reminisce on seeing what happened in the last decade, but builders were, you know, I don't care if you looked at any major builder, they were putting up whole divisions with spec homes because the market was so hot. This time, builders have been more circumspect. If they're opening up one phase, they don't open up phase two until everything is sold. So there's been a lot more conservatism, and there's been less of a supply, which I think is helping to drive up some of these prices, especially here in California.
Yeah, absolutely. The lack of good labor, skilled labor, it's just the cost of the materials. Absolutely, we've seen most of the new phases that have come out have been very small, compared to the boom and compared to the 2005, 2006 boom. Where you're right, there was phases of new homes with hundreds of homes, and especially in San Diego, we've just seen these small phases, and they've been, maybe there was 12 homes in a phase or 15 homes, and they would sell out pretty quick, but. And it just kind of goes along with what you were saying. It just the inventory has been light, and builders have been very cautious to put their neck out like they did back in 2005.
How would you contrast this economic recovery in real estate compared to, let's say, the last decade when you had things like no-doc loans, ninja loans? I mean, basically, you just make up stuff to qualify for a home. How would you contrast that market in the last decade to the way the market's being run today?
Very good question. I mean, when anyone can get a loan, that just increases the demand for a home or for a loan, because it just so many people can qualify. And today's market, it still is very, very driven by ability to repay. The ATR rule that came out with the Dodd-Frank laws. And so that's really made it still very difficult to get a mortgage for self-employed people. For the people that are W-2'd and have a regular wage or a job, they still can qualify pretty easily with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and some government loans. But for the self-employed, it really makes it difficult because the write-offs and different things that they're taking advantage of. It really shows in their income that they just maybe on paper can't afford the home that they actually can afford. They think in their head, like, I can afford this, whatever payment it is. Say it's a $5,000 payment a month. I can afford that payment. But on paper, it tells a different story. Their tax return says, no, you couldn't afford that payment. So it makes it very difficult. And I think it's frustrating for a lot of self-employed people when they go to a bank and they say, here's my tax returns, or I don't have a pay stub, but here's my P&L. And the banker comes back and says, well, no, you can't afford that. And, they're scratching their head. But it is a reality today that makes it very difficult still. And so with that being said, I think, one of the statistics was, I think it's 38% of the U.S. Employment market is self-employed. And I know that's on the rise. I think Forbes said by 2020, it'd be almost 50% of the labor force will have some element of freelance work. In their job, maybe they're having one or two jobs. They have a regular job, but then they have a side hustle or a gig, kind of a gig economy side job. So, that makes it, even if they think they can afford that house, it makes it difficult for them to actually qualify on paper for it. So it makes them either, buy a cheaper home or, stay renting, because a lot of people really enjoy the home that they're in. They don't want to suffer and take a less expensive house if that's all that they can afford on a bank. So maybe they go private money, or they, do things creatively, like use a margin loan on their stock portfolio. But certainly, yeah, we've seen a lot of, it's a lot different from the market that was in 2005, 2006. It's very different.
Now, you have a special niche in the mortgage market. You deal on the higher end. You deal with a lot of entrepreneurs. Most of your mortgages are $1 million or more. They're jumbo mortgages. And a lot of your business is securitized, or you sell it to, large fund families like a PIMCO or hedge fund managers. Explain that market and what makes it unique and what attracted you to it. And how does that differ from, let's say, John, me walking into a bank, and let's just say, well, in California, a lot of your mortgages could end up being jumbos just because of the value of real estate.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it comes with the territory. Yeah, we're in Southern California, so you know naturally your average home price is going to be up there, and then you deal with, you know, if we chose to deal with self-employed borrowers because that was a niche that I felt was underserved. And you know, of course, if you're dealing with self-employed people, then often you know they might have a good business, and so they're making really good money, and then naturally that they want to buy a really nice house. And so, you know, that led us to you know really start doing, you know, our expertise and our specialty and our niche has been really the high-end jumbo for self-employed borrowers. And part of that also is that, you know, like I said, it was underserved. There was a lack of products for those type of borrowers. You know, if you go to a bank or a regular lender, they tend to have caps. So, you know, they say, well, we're not going to go for $2 million, or we're not going to go over, you know, two. Usually there's like a threshold, so it might be $2.5 million. Even on the private client side of, say, like a Chase Bank or, you know, Wells Fargo, they still, even though they have, you know, they're a little bit more lenient with borrowers who have money in their bank. Like, if, let's say they have a nice portfolio at their bank, they might be more lenient on some of the guidelines and things like that, but they still have rules and laws that they just have to abide by. But you know, it really opened up a nice need and a niche for us, and that's why we went after it, and we just became really, really good at it because it's like all we're it's 100% of what we're focused on. We don't do in the morning a reverse mortgage or a VA loan, and then in the afternoon do a what we call a non-QM loan, which is non-qualified. But that's a term that was made up. Recently, it really is a loan that just doesn't fit into, you know, the box that the agencies require, the Fannie and Freddie agencies. But so this market really, you know, it's for borrowers who just don't fit perfectly into those boxes. And, you know, as you know, we're all human, and there's an element that sometimes we just can't fit into. And it, so it really creates an opportunity for someone like us and a company like us to come in and say, well, you know, we can do this, and the rates are pretty good still. I mean, they're not going to be, you know, we are selling to hedge funds and to private equity funds. And so their cost of funds is going to be a little bit higher than, say, you know, a First National Bank or, you know, Chase Bank or something like that.
John, how would you contrast this? You mentioned earlier that for somebody that's self-employed, they walk into the bank, they know they can afford a higher valued home, but the bank, because they're looking at the tax return, looks at it from a different perspective, and they say, no, I'm sorry, you don't qualify. What do you guys do that's different? Because you're working in a larger market, number one. And number two, your customers, when you make these loans, are going to be hedge funds. They're going to be the PIMCOs of the world.
Right.
And so I imagine they have some pretty strict requirements and do a lot more credit analysis.
Yeah. So it is an expanded matrix. So if you look at, you know, like a Chase matrix for what kind of loans they offer, and then you look at ours, you'll see it looks pretty similar, but where we expand and the way that we do things differently is we don't look at your tax returns. A lot of the stuff in mortgages is a little, it's not very, you know, quote, make sense, you know, unquote. And that's because they've tried to automate it over the years with a thing called DU and LP, which is Desktop Underwriter and Loan Prospector. It's an agency, you know, attempt to automate the process. And it's worked fairly well for traditional loans and things like that. But the way we do it, and it's something that's fairly new. You know, there were programs like this before the crash, but we take 24 months of a bank statement, whether it's personal bank statements or business bank statements. We'll look at the last 24, and the reason why I say that the mortgage business is it looks back. So it looks typically a look back on what did you make, say, in 2017? What did you make in 2018? And for a self-employed borrower, you'll look at their history. And then you'll look at maybe a P&L. That's how they would look at it. Well, the way we would look at it is really, really close to, you know, today's snapshot of what their income looks like. So we'll go back and say, what did you make in the last 12 months? Let's look at all your deposits. Let's aggregate those into a spreadsheet. And then let's look at it. If it's a personal bank statement loan, we'll take that. Let's say it's, you know, 10 grand a month. So you times that by 12, you get $120,000 for the year. So if it's a personal bank statement loan, we'll take 100% of those deposits and we'll subtract out anything that just is not business income. Say you sold a watch, or you, you know, got some money from a refund of, you know, your taxes or something like that, and it wasn't really business income or wasn't considered true income. We'll take that out, exclude that, but we'll take 100% of those other deposits, and we'll look at your bank statements, and we get to see everything. We get to see what they spend their money on. We get to see, you know, if there's any NSFs, what's at the end of the month, what's left over, and really get to take a good picture of what their income looks like. And so we use that, and we found that that method has been, you know, tremendous as far as what kind of credit risk that these people are. And then on the business side, so if that doesn't work, because not everyone puts their money into a personal checking account. So a lot of self-employed people put their money into a business checking account. And so what we'll do with that is, there's several ways. We have about 8 different methods, but I'll just tell you one or two. And so probably the most common way is we'll look at the most recent 12 months of business deposits. And then we'll look at we can either get a CPA to give us an expense ratio, or we can have what we call a borrower prepared P&L. And so your borrower will then go through and say, these are my, my absolute costs for me to run my business. And, you know, the way that self-employed people write off things on their tax returns is what they're using the law, they're using the tax code. And it's an advantage for self-employed people, because generally they can pay less taxes than if they were W-2'd, and there's good reasons for that. But, you know, in this case, you're gonna show just your hard costs, and so then you can look at your business bank statements and say, here's what you make after your expenses, and then we put that into your income box on the application. And so it's not stated income per se. It's more like bank stated income. The bank is telling us what they make, not necessarily the borrower, because that's what really got us, I think, into trouble before the crash was, you know, borrowers stating their income. And oftentimes they would lie, or they would, you know, the mortgage broker would, you know, get them to, you know, to push that up higher just so they would qualify. But in this case, we're actually seeing truly what that income is based off of, you know, true bank deposits. So it's, these loans are very low risk. We've seen actually a lower default rate than Fannie and Freddie.
You know what is interesting? As the Fed brought us through QE and mortgage rates got down, I'm thinking of the summer of 2016 when we got down to 1.3% on the 10-year Treasury. Investors, hedge funds, bond funds have gone out on the risk spectrum. We've seen the rise and the doubling of leveraged loans. You've seen private equity. So how does what you do fit into, I would suspect it's probably less risk because, yes, you know, you're making a loan, but you, I would assume you have substantial equity that the homeowner provides on the house that you're lending on.
Absolutely. These are all collateralized loans, and they are so the asset class is really great. I mean, if you look at these type of loans that we're doing, the non-QM jumbo side, you really can look at a profile of a loan that has, let's say, 30% equity. So our average loan-to-value ratio is about 70%. And so there's lots of room. There's lots of skin in the game, you know, the borrower has. And so not only that, they've got, you know, we've been able to really analyze their income. And then they're also, on top of that, paying a higher coupon than, you know, what you would see out there on a traditional bond. So, you know, our coupons are in the sixes typically. We have loans that we do that are in the fives, but they're 5/1 arms, 7/1 arms. Sometimes they're 30-year fixed. We even have a 40-year fixed product that has a 10-year interest only duration in the beginning. Which is great. What's great about that is that it literally, after 10 years of interest only, it converts into then a 30-year fix at the same rate. So you're not having that, you know, that typical jump up where, you know, got people in trouble. So these loans are a great asset class, and you know, with a good coupon, with really great. Now they haven't been tested, like there hasn't been a major crash, but, you know, from my experience in previous company that I owned, you know, really to understand the foreclosure crisis and what caused people to walk away and do strategic default was really the no skin in the game. And so this is a completely different type of loan where we've analyzed their income and they have skin in the game.
How different is it taking what you do and given where your customers are? Your customers are hedge funds. Your customers are large bond fund companies like a PIMCO. What kind of restraints or requirements or analysis do they put on you in terms of, let's say, buying a mortgage pool?
So the pools themselves, they have their own. So they'll either look at our set of guidelines and approve them prior to us starting to sell them loans, or they will issue a set of guidelines that they're willing to buy, or a buy box, as we call them. And so we'll underwrite around their buy box and their guides. Or we'll say, hey, this is what we know we can, produce $20 million a month of, or this particular, product we can give you $30 million a month of. So they look at it and they say, yeah, we like those guidelines, or, there's one thing in here we won't buy. So you either need to change that or alter it to fit kind of more what we want. But they're definitely have their standards and their guidelines and matrices that we follow.
Given what you do, let's say I'm an entrepreneur, I have my own business, and let's say, I get the itch, I want to trade up, I want to get a bigger home. What are my choices? They're either, I go to the bank and the bank turns me down, or maybe there's companies like yours.
Absolutely, yeah. So we're a wholesale lender. So you could go to almost any mortgage broker out there and say, hey, I want a loan I want you to broker to fund loans. And we have our own products, we have our own rate sheets, and so that mortgage broker could basically look at our products and say, yeah, you fit into this particular program. And our minimum down, we have a product is, if you're really ultra stellar credit box, we have as little as 5% down on certain products, but most of our products require 10% or more down. For a bank statement type of loan, it's a minimum of 10% down. But yeah, we go all the way up to $15 million. So you could be, out there really crushing it in your business, and you just want to, you really want to not have to pay private money rates, or you don't want to have to use up all your cash, and you want to do a little leverage. Then certainly you can get one of our type of loans. And we also have a retail side called Drop Mortgage. So that retail side, you could, go there and get a loan through one of our loan officers.
Given your years of experience in the business, how would you assess where we are in the business cycle and the markets right now with real estate and lending?
Great question. I think about this a lot because, you hear people say we're overdue for a crash and there's this going to be a massive housing crash and all this stuff. So it's really interesting to me because, it's obviously my area of focus and my business, and everything that I'm doing is revolving around this. So I pay a lot of attention to it. And so we're what it feels like to me, it feels like a lot like 2001. And when I say that, the reason why I'm saying that is because I remember back in 2001 when there was a lot of new credit programs coming out to the market. It just right after the dot-com bubble, and I believe a lot of money started shifting over into the hedge fund and private equity, and REITs started popping up and expanding some of these loan programs. So what happened was I would get faxes every morning with the rates, and then on top of the rate sheet for that particular lender would be an announcement of a new product. And so we would, very often get, new jumbo product with a lower credit score. So you'd see these expansions happening. Right now, over the last year and a half, there's been a lot of that, even the last 2 years. So maybe it's like 2002 in the mortgage cycle, where products are expanding, more money is going into this side and the private side, and you'll see, new programs come out. Also, inventory hasn't been, hasn't grown a ton, where in 2002, 2001, there wasn't a ton of inventory yet. It really started coming in later, towards 2004, 2005, 2006. And so, we haven't seen that the builders really start loosening yet. And so I think once they do, And maybe they won't, but because there is a lack of skilled labor and the cost of materials is high, but but it really does feel like 2002 to me in the mortgage cycle. I know it's different in the overall stock market and everything like that, but for me in mortgages, that's really where it feels similar to.
Well, listen, John, if our listeners would like to find out more about what you do at Fund Loans, tell them how they could do so, please.
Absolutely. Fundloans.com is our website. And then dropmortgage.com is our retail website. So either one of those you can go to, and we'll be happy to discuss with you guys some options.
All right. Well, listen, John, thanks for coming on the program and updating us as we continue to follow the real estate market. All the best, sir, and come back again.
Thanks so much, Jim.
And coming up in Hour 2, The Big Picture, we set a record this week. The national debt rose to $22 trillion, and we're not even in a recession. Well, why aren't people talking about this? Also, Jim Poplava wrote an article about a financial crisis in the Roman Empire in 33 AD that involved efforts to stimulate real estate, and it led to a credit crisis eventually solved by quantitative easing. 33 AD, quantitative easing, and negative interest rates have a long history. That's coming up in Hour 2, The Big Picture.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.